Have you ever seen the movie Suicide Squad? It came out a few years ago based on a comic book by the same name. They're working on a sequel slash relaunch now with a new director and some new key character swaps. DC Comics is trying to get all the mileage out of their fan-favorite character Harley Quinn that they can, especially after her solo film Birds of Prey flopped so badly a few months ago. Now, as far as superhero movies go, Suicide Squad was pretty good. It was fun. The major villain seemed to serve as more of a placeholder while the stories of the various quote-unquote heroes were told. But in that arena, at least, they hit a home run as far as I was concerned. It made enough money to prompt the sequels that I mentioned, but I can't see how it'll serve as much more than a minor rabbit trail in the larger cinematic universe DC Comics is still trying to build in hopes of rivaling the juggernaut that Marvel's put together. So far, they're staying pretty far behind in terms of both quality and box office returns. In any event, the movie itself is about a team of superhuman villains put together by a ruthless government agent to be used for missions that they don't expect anybody to survive. Thus the name Suicide Squad, get it? And as far as bad guys go, these are some of the worst, or you know, at least the scariest of the worst. There's a big guy who's part crocodile, a guy who's really a fire demon in the body of a man, a contract killer with hundreds of kills to his name, a bank robber with multiple kills under his belt, and Batman's arch enemy, the Joker's girlfriend, who's even crazier than he is. If you think about it, even though she's really the star of the show, she seems like the least harmless of the bunch. She doesn't have any special powers or skills. She's just crazy. Well, these are all folks who never think twice about taking what they want from whomever they want and killing anybody who gets in their way. The whole point of the story, though, is that when put in a situation with the fate of the world and their newfound teammates is on the line, they embrace the selfless heroism that lies at the heart of all of us and do the right thing. There's even a brief but pivotal scene right near the end where the bank robber character has a choice between stealing a really nice watch and grabbing hold of the one thing that can kill the real villain. And he opts for the latter. It's a story with a strong theme of redemption to it, even if in the end the whole lot wind up back in prison where they belong and where they will stay until further notice. If you think about it, this is one of the fundamental assumptions of nearly every story we see in our culture today. The redemption, not the prison. At our most basic level, people are good. We may be broken, but somewhere inside lies the kind of person we all know we should be, and given the right set of, usually extreme, circumstances, this virtuous person will rise to the top, and we will become the people who had previously only ever existed in the land of potentiality. The bottom line, though, is that with the exception of the really bad guys who tend to die in the end, so we don't have to worry much about them anymore, all of us has a good line in our core, and it only needs to be accessed and coaxed to the top. When we're given the chance to follow our hearts and do what we really want to do, great things will be the result. Doing this will bring redemption for any number of past wrongs. This is a storyline of great hopefulness. It's encouraging, it's inspiring, and it pretty much totally ignores reality. The truth is that people can, and occasionally do, achieve great things, heroic things, awe-inspiring things. But that's pretty much without exception the result of their getting all caught up in a vision of something larger than themselves. It was certainly the case in the movie. No, where we are left to our own devices and set free to pursue whatever our hearts desire, the results are usually somewhat more troubling than the greatness we see so often put on display in the stories our culture tells these days. For instance, in the movie, the team of heroic villains is walking down a deserted street in a commercial area of the city. Harley sees a purse in one of the windows and without a word smashes the glass and takes it. While the rest of the team looks at her in total confusion as to what she's doing, she quickly fires back, "We're the bad guys, duh." That's what it looks like when we do what we want. And nowhere is this put more brilliantly on display than in the final story arc of the Book of Judges. This morning, we're in the sixth part of our series, Going It Alone, and this week will take us to the end of the Book of Judges, but not quite to the end of our story. We'll get to that next week. In any event, the big idea for this whole series has been that this wild little book offers us a very much compelling picture of what it looks like when we try and do life on our own. Simply put, when we try and go it alone in life, things never go well for us. A big part of the reason for this, as we saw in the first couple of weeks of the series, is that disobedience has consequences. And when we allow ourselves to form bad habits in life instead of habits of righteousness, we lock ourselves into a place where we can't experience anything but those hard consequences. Now, God isn't content to leave us in our misery. He quickly grows impatient with our misery, just as he did that of the people of Israel. And so he comes along and calls us to opportunities to set new habits in place and get back on track with following. And he gives us seasons kind of like this one. Well, through the stories of Barak and Gideon, though, we saw that if we refuse these calls, and we never have to take them, he'll call someone else. And all the blessings he had intended to give us will go to them instead. In the meantime, we'll run the risk of laying in place a legacy of faithlessness that can wipe away the fruits of God's faithfulness. It's a dangerous game to play, but when we're determined to go it alone, it's the only game there is. Finally, last week, we stepped back a bit, and although we, yes, looked at the stories of a couple more judges, we saw that the heart of the problem for Israel lied with the people, not the leaders. The leaders were bad, to be sure, no question about that, but if the people weren't willing to follow God, the leaders weren't going to do it either. If you'll remember, I pushed us all just a bit with some tough observations about our current cultural situation and the quote-unquote leaders who are currently vying for the office of president. Until we make certain we are fully on track with where we're supposed to be, we can't get too upset at our leaders for not doing the same. Neither, though, are we totally innocent of their failings, as they are merely products of our culture. Well, this morning, things are going to get really dark. I told you that last week. I pointed out last week that by the time Samson finished leading the people, they were a spiritual and moral wreck. He was in almost every way a fitting reflection of where the people themselves were. When each of the previous judges died, the people were not in a great spot, but things could have always gotten worse. By the time Samson died, worse had run out. There was nothing left for them to do but hit the bottom. And hit it they did. The people had been insistent on going it alone in spite of God's best attempts to draw them back to doing life his way. So, he finally let them. He let them go all the way as far as they wanted. He put no roadblocks in their path. Nothing was off limits to them. And the results, well, that's what I want to talk about with you this morning. This final fall of Israel started out weird. We read in Judges 17 about a man named Micah, not the Micah my little boy's named after, who stole some money from his mom and later gave it back. First, who steals from your mom? More importantly, though, is the mom's reaction. We're not told about any anger or resentment or loss of trust on her part. Instead, listen, she takes some of the money, has a local silversmith make a literal idol statue out of it, gives it to her son, who then takes it and basically invents his own religion with one of his sons ordained as his priest. Crazy, right? But then it gets worse. A Levite man from Bethlehem, yes, that Bethlehem, is traveling around until he finds someone in need of his services. Well, he and Micah hit it off, and Micah hires him to be his own personal priest, from Judges chapter 17, verse 10. Micah replied, "Stay with me and be my father and priest, and I will give you 4 ounces of silver a year along with your clothing and provisions." So the Levite went in and agreed to stay with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons. Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in Micah's house. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, because a Levite has become my priest." Now, what exactly about any part of the situation made Micah think the Lord was going to bless him in it is beyond me. But his whole thought process reveals just how essentially pagan the people have become in their thinking. I mean, this guy broke at least half the Ten Commandments in doing all this, and then he has the gall to say, Yeah, I think God's going to bless all this. What a fool. But then, if you can believe it, things get even weirder. In what appears to be a completely unrelated shift in focus, the author next tells us that the tribe of Dan still hadn't claimed any land for their inheritance. Well, we're multiple generations past the point they should have had that settled, but I digress. The tribal leaders finally decide to do something about it. Why now? Who knows? They send some scouts around the land to see if they could find a suitable place for the group to settle. As they're traveling around, they come within range of Micah's house and land, hear the Levite's voice, recognize his accent as local to them, and go talk to him. Listen to this now from Judges chapter 18, starting at verse 3. While they were near Micah's home, they recognized the accent of the young Levite. So they went over to him and asked, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What's keeping you here?" He told them, Well, this is what Mike has done for me. He's hired me, and I became his priest. Then they said to him, please, inquire of God for us to determine if we will have a successful journey. The priest told them, without ever actually consulting with God, by the way, go in peace. The Lord is watching over the journey you're going on. The scouts leave, find a town they like, go get their army, come back to Micah's place, and take both the Levite and Micah's idol by force to be their god and priest, go on to the town, massacre all the inhabitants, claim it as their own, move in. But if you think the wheels have fallen off the bus, just wait. The whole engine's about to drop out of it, and the windows are going to blow out just for good measure. Some number of years later, this young Levite has grown and presumably gotten married and even picked up a concubine for himself. He's doing well, right? Well, for some reason, she leaves him and goes back home to her father's house. Now, the Hebrew here isn't totally clear. It could be understood to say that she had been unfaithful to him or simply that she wasn't happy with him. Either way, she leaves. Eventually, the Levite decides he misses her and goes to her father's house to get her back. Well, the dad welcomes him graciously, but does everything he can to delay his taking his daughter away from him, which he would have been legally entitled to do, by the way. Finally, the Levite says, that's enough, we're leaving now, and heads back to his home. Well, the party leaves late enough that they aren't going to be able to make it all the way there before nightfall. As a result, they start looking for a place to stay, kind of like a family traveling across the country might start searching for exits for hotels to spend the night before going on the next day. In this culture, though, there weren't any hotels. The unwritten but firm rule of hospitality was that you would travel to the center of town and someone would invite you to stay in their home. Well, the first town they pass when they start looking for a place to stay was actually Jerusalem, but it wasn't an Israelite town yet. If you'll remember back to the beginning of Judges, it was a town the tribe of Benjamin had tried to capture but couldn't. It was held by the Jebusites still and known as Jebus. The Levite refuses to stay in this foreign town, presumably because such an ungodly people couldn't be expected to adhere to the basic rules of common decency. Instead, they go a bit further and come to the town of Gibeah in the territory of Benjamin, a good Israelite town. They travel to the town center where they sit and wait. But in a moment of deep irony, nobody invites them to stay. The priest was skeptical of the character of the non-Israelites, and yet here the Israelites reveal they don't have any character either. Finally, an old farmer on his way home notices them there. The exchange is revealing in Judges chapter 19 now, verse 17. When he looked up and saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, "Where are you going and where do you come from?" He answered him, "We're traveling from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote hill country of Ephraim where I am from. I went to Bethlehem in Judah and now I'm going to the house of the Lord. No one has taken me into his home, although there's straw and feed for the donkeys, and I have bread and wine for me, my concubine, and the servant with us. There's nothing we lack." "Welcome," said the old man. "I'll take care of everything you need. Only don't spend the night in the square." So he brought them to his house and fed the donkeys. Then they washed their feet and ate and drank. Now, this conversation may seem fairly inconsequential to you, but rest assured, in the eyes of someone living at that time, it would have been a powerful indictment of the moral state of the people of Gibeah. The man who would not have been a burden to anyone beyond creating some extra space for his party couldn't find anyone willing to help them. How could a people have fallen so far as to lose even a basic sense of hospitality? Well, the answer to the question, and the full truth, is actually much worse than we might think. While the Levite and his servants were at the old man's house, a mob from the town came together, headed straight for his house, pounded on the door, and demanded of him in verse 22, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him." And no, they aren't interested in learning his life story. Now, this kind of thing actually happened before in the scriptures. You know where? Genesis 19, in the narrative detailing the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. The story then was told to offer evidence that God was right to totally obliterate the two cities because of the extent to which they'd embraced an absolutely evil ethic. And here the people of Israel have sunk to that level. How could this be? How could anybody fall to such a depth of depravity? Well, unlike in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, there weren't any angels here to strike the mob with blindness, causing them to disperse. Instead, the Levite finally takes matters into his own hands, which is notable in the sense that the host didn't deal with the issue, the guest had to, which represents yet another breakdown in basic hospitality. And, you know, I'm just going to read this to you because I don't think I can make this any more graphic than the scriptures do. I don't need to. Verse 25. But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and took her outside to them. They raped her and abused her all night until morning. At daybreak, they let her go. Early that morning, the woman made her way back, and as it was getting light, she collapsed at the doorway of the man's house where her master was. When her master got up in the morning, opened the doors of the house, and went to leave out on his journey, there was the woman, his concubine, collapsed near the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. "Get up," he told her, "let's go." But there was no response. So the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. When he entered his house, he picked up a knife, took hold of his concubine, cut her into 12 pieces limb by limb, and then sent her throughout the territory of Israel. Everyone who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or has been since the day the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt until now. Think it over, discuss it, and speak up." In other words, folks, the bus has fallen apart all the way down to the nuts and bolts. We've hit the rock bottom of morality. We need to do something about this. And so they do. The other 11 tribes get together and decide to launch a civil war against the people of Benjamin for the gross transgressions of the men of Gibeah. They offer them a chance to repent and turn the men over for punishing, but Benjamin refuses and takes up arms to defend itself. Twice, the warriors of Benjamin prove more than able to deal devastating defeats to the army of the rest of the tribes. Finally, the majority changes tactics and not only defeats, but wipes out the entire tribe, save 600 men who manage to escape to the hills. At this point, the people are gripped by guilt over their near destruction of their brothers and sisters and decide to relent. But they have a problem. They've all sworn an oath to not give their daughters as wives to anyone from Benjamin. How is the tribe to replenish its numbers? The solution? They give them permission to kidnap 600 young women from the town of Shiloh. And when its leaders rightly object, they're essentially told to keep their mouths shut since they didn't participate in the civil war and should all be killed for this failure anyway. At long last, then, everybody goes home to let the dust settle. Yet again, we have to come back to this question. How did all this happen? How does a people go from saved by God to utter moral chaos in the span of just a few generations? Well, the answer to this question is found in the very last verse of the book. It's a dark, depressing end to a dark, depressing chapter in the history of Israel. Listen to this in Judges 21:25. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Now, that's not the first time this line appears in the story. Way back in chapter 17, just after we're told about Micah making his idol, we see the same thing in verse 6 there. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. You know how else you might put that? Everyone was being true to himself. Or how about this? Everyone was following her own heart. Or maybe this: if it felt good, they did it. While our culture might proclaim such ideas to be good, right, and true, the scriptures tell a different tale. That kind of thinking is a recipe for disaster. Or perhaps, to put that another way, doing what's right in our own eyes never ends well. Israel has fallen off the face of a moral cliff here precisely because they rejected the ways of God and set about going it alone. They strove to be their own standard for right and wrong and unfortunately never chose right again. And that's the point here. That's how they could have fallen to such a state. Doing what's right in our own eyes never ends well. No, folks, I hardly think I need to say it, but the implications here for us and our culture are pretty clear. We live in a day and time when the banner idea that lies behind pretty much everything we're told is good, right, and true is, if it feels good, do it. Be who you really are. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the advice given to follow your heart or look inside for your path or some other mumbo jumbo like that. Frankly, I'm disturbed how often I hear it in the shows my kids watch. It's all over Disney Plus, for instance. Just be true to yourself and everything will work out okay in the end. I mentioned John Krasinski's YouTube show, Some Good News, a couple of times on here. For fans of the show, it was picked up by CBS and will be getting some more episodes, but Krasinski will not be hosting, which I don't think is a good thing, but that's just me. In any event, a few weeks ago, he did a graduation-themed episode featuring Oprah and Steven Spielberg, among others. Their advice to the grads was fully consistent with this trend. You're good enough all by yourself. Okay, but just out of curiosity, what if yourself is a jerk? I mean, if your inner self is like, I don't know, a serial killer, then I don't want you to be true to yourself. I want you to be true to somebody else. Pick almost anybody else. When we're committed to doing what's right in our own eyes, unless our eyes are perfect, which they aren't, we're cooking with a recipe for disaster. Doing what's right in our own eyes never ends well. Look, the common assumption that people are basically good, it's a farce. It's a lie. It's an oceanside view in Montana. You and I are broken on the inside. Apart from Christ, we don't desire the good, the true, and the beautiful. We desire the selfish, the false, and the ugly. The prophet Jeremiah wrote in 17:9, "The heart is more deceitful than anything else and incurable. Who can understand it?" Or as Paul wrote in Romans 3:10, "As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There's no one who understands. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned away. All alike have become worthless. There's no one who does what is good, not even one." Or perhaps as Jesus himself put it in Matthew 15:10, "It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth. This defiles a person. Don't you realize that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated? But what comes out of the mouth comes from the heart, and this defiles a person." Now, have you ever had the experience of saying or thinking something or maybe doing something and then thinking to yourself, "Oh my goodness, where did that come from? That wasn't me." Of course it was. You may not have realized it was there, but it only came out of you because it was there. People are like tubes of toothpaste. When you squeeze a tube of toothpaste, what comes out of it? Toothpaste. What a trick question. Now, why does the toothpaste come out of it? Because that's what's inside of it. You don't squeeze a tube of toothpaste expecting to get maple syrup out of it unless you're crazy. The only thing that's going to come out of that tube is toothpaste because that's the only thing inside it. Well, the only things that come out of us are what are in us. And what lies inside of us, apart from the active involvement of the Holy Spirit, isn't pretty. Doing what's right in our own eyes never ends well. What we need as individuals and as a whole culture is to give up entirely on the idea that we know what's best for ourselves, or even that the government does. Both of those are lies and lead to either anarchy or totalitarianism. Instead, we must submit ourselves to a higher standard, God's, and commit to doing what's right in His eyes. I don't need to convince you that we're in a place as a nation that's not so far removed from where Israel was. A few hours of watching the news should take care of that. What put them there was their commitment to doing what's right in their own eyes. Listen, that's exactly the path we're on. The kick is that we can easily convince ourselves that we're not because of the deceitfulness of our hearts that Jeremiah mentioned. The simple truth, though, is that following our hearts is a folly. It will lead us astray every single time. Doing what's right in our own eyes never ends well. And so then, let us here and now commit to doing something different. Let us commit to doing life God's way. How do we do that? We start by studying stories just like this one, so that this powerful truth stays right before our eyes. And then we go on to the rest of the scriptures in regular, healthy bites so that we can learn the way that leads to life. Not just learn it, in fact, but live it. We live it by putting it into practice. We stop following our own heart and start chasing after God's. It's a long race, to be sure, but it's one that ends in victory.